right at this very moment, literally as we are talking, a $250 million space telescope is just tumbling completely out of control.
Yeah, right over our heads, about 600 kilometers up.
Exactly. And its orbit is decaying by the hour. But in just a short while, a small robotic spacecraft is going to attempt to chase it down and basically catch it before it burns up.
It is an incredibly delicate operation. I mean, we are essentially watching a high-stakes heist in low Earth orbit.
A space heist.
Basically, yeah.
Shit.
But, what makes this launch truly historic isn't just about saving this one specific telescope.
Right.
This is a live fire test for a future space economy that, well, analysts project it'll be worth upwards of $10 billion by the end of the decade.
10 billion. Wow.
Yeah, we are watching the birth of a completely new era in orbital mechanics today.
Well, welcome to today's deep dive. If you've been keeping an eye on the news, you know there's just a massive amount of chatter about this operation right now.
Oh, absolutely. It's everywhere.
So we are taking the stack of articles, research papers, and mission briefings you provided to unpack the launch of this LNK spacecraft.
Which is NASA's first ever robotic rescue of a satellite that was absolutely not designed to be serviced, like at all.
Not in any capacity. To put this in perspective for you, listening right now, if you have ever fumbled your phone and watched it fall in slow motion,
Oh, the worst feeling.
the absolute worst. Desperately wishing someone could swoop in and catch it before it shatters on the concrete, right? You are going to appreciate this mission.
Definitely. Except in this case, the phone is a quarter of a billion-dollar scientific instrument,
Yeah, and the concrete is the friction of the Earth's atmosphere.
which is why the tension across the aerospace industry is so palpable today. I mean, the margin for error here is essentially zero.
Let's start with the victim of our story, right? The telescope that is currently in free fall, the Neil Gehrels Swift Observatory. Exactly. When you look at the payload of Swift, it's clear this isn't just some random piece of flying metal. Swift has an astonishing 22-year legacy.
It's a scientific powerhouse.
It really is. It remains the only observatory humanity has that is capable of simultaneous gamma ray, X-ray, and UV, or, optical observation.
And a remarkably resilient one at that. I mean, Swift was originally designed for a primary mission lifespan of just 2 years.
2 years. Wait, back when it launched in 2004.
Yeah, 2004. It has outlived that projection by two full decades.
That's
It
incredible.
really has become one of the most prolific astronomical tools in history.
And the things this telescope has witnessed are they're staggering. Swift has detected over 1,700 gamma ray bursts.
Which are the most powerful explosions in the known universe, by the way?
Right. We are talking about capturing the exact moments when black holes are born, detecting light that has traveled across the void for more than 13 billion light years just to reach
Yeah,
us.
the data is invaluable.
And my absolute favorite detail from the briefings in 2017, Swift was instrumental in observing a neutron star collision.
Oh, that was a monumental milestone for astrophysics.
Right.
We achieved simultaneous gravitational wave detection and electromagnetic light detection from the exact same cosmic event.
And the reason that matters to you, the listener, why you should care about that specific collision is because it proved the origin of heavy elements. If you are wearing a gold ring or a platinum necklace today, Swift literally helped discover the cosmic forge where the metal in your jewelry was originally created.
It is an irreplaceable asset. I mean, neither the James Webb Telescope nor Hubble can pivot and react to a sudden gamma ray burst with the speed and precision that Swift can.
But despite all its capabilities, Swift is currently losing a battle against an invisible force.
Yeah, people often forget that at 600 kilometers up, you aren't actually in deep space yet.
You're still kind of in the atmosphere, right?
Exactly. You're still skimming the absolute upper edge of Earth's exosphere. While it is incredibly sparse, there are still trace gas particles up there.
Okay.
This means any satellite in low Earth orbit is constantly fighting a very weak but persistent drag force. And over time, that drag slowly saps a spacecraft's orbital energy.
But under normal circumstances, that orbital decay is, well, it's agonizingly slow, isn't it?
Usually, yeah.
Swift was placed high enough that it was supposed to maintain its altitude for several decades without issue.
Right, but the environment up there recently changed drastically.
Yeah, the unexpected villain in this scenario was the 2024 to 2026 solar cycle peak.
Yeah, this wasn't just a minor fluctuation. This particular solar maximum exceeded almost all scientific predictions.
It was massive.
It really was. What's fascinating here is the physical mechanism of how a solar storm actually pulls a satellite down toward Earth.
Right, because it's not like the sun is literally grabbing it.
No, no. When the sun's activity peaks, it bombards the Earth with intense ultraviolet radiation and X-rays. That massive influx of solar energy is absorbed by our upper atmosphere, and it heats up significantly.
And basic physics tells us that when gases heat up, they expand.
Exactly. The atmosphere literally puffs outward, much like a balloon inflating.
Oh, wow.
So the exosphere swells, meaning those sparse gas layers suddenly reach much higher altitudes than they normally would.
Okay, so a recent 2026 study from Frontiers University synthesized this data beautifully, didn't they?
They did, yeah.
They found that when solar activity exceeds 67% of its maximum threshold, the density of the atmosphere at standard satellite altitudes just spikes dramatically.
It shoots way up.
The decay rates of satellites in those lanes, they don't just increase a little bit, they completely plummet.
So Swift, which was sitting happily in what it thought was empty space at 600 kilometers, suddenly found itself swimming through a newly expanded, much thicker layer of gas.
Swimming in gas.
Yeah, the drag became severe. The data shows its orbit drops from 600 kilometers down to 360 kilometers in just 2 years.
That is wild. A fall that should have taken decades happened in the blink of an eye.
Which is what triggered the ticking clock we're dealing with today.
Yeah.
Swift now has only about 6 months left before it experiences uncontrolled reentry.
And just burns up entirely in the thicker parts of the atmosphere.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second. If my 22-year-old car breaks down on the highway,
yeah,
I certainly don't spend millions of dollars to fix a vehicle with 250,000 miles on it. I call a tow truck to scrap it, and I buy a new one.
Fair point.
Swift is a technological dinosaur by today's standards. I mean, computing power alone has advanced light years since 2004.
Oh, without a doubt.
So why is NASA spending tens of millions of dollars to save a dying machine rather than just launching a modern replacement?
It is a completely fair question, and the justification really comes down to two inescapable constraints, pure economics and time.
Okay, lay it on me.
According to NASA's principal investigator for Swift, Dr. Brad Chenko, designing and building a brand new updated observatory with similar capabilities would cost roughly $250 million.
See, that is a massive capital investment for an agency that already has its budget stretched thin across all the lunar and Mars programs.
Completely. And worse than the financial cost is the temporal cost.
The time it takes.
Right. It would take a minimum of 5 to 7 years to design, build, meticulously test, and finally launch a replacement telescope.
Oh, I see.
In that 5 to 7 year gap, the scientific community would be completely blind to thousands of gamma ray bursts.
Because we don't have anything else that can do what Swift does.
Exactly. We would lose the capability to observe these crucial, fleeting cosmic events. The scientific cost of a half-decade blind spot is simply unacceptable to astrophysicists.
Okay, so compare that to the rescue mission we are watching today. The LNK mission is costing just $30 million. That is only 12% of the cost of building a new observatory. If they can extend Swift's operational life by even 5 to 10 years, it is an exceptional bargain for the scientific community.
It really is. But with a timeline of only 6 months before Swift burns up, NASA faced a severe logistical nightmare.
Because NASA does not move fast.
They don't.
Mm-hmm.
A standard NASA mission of this complexity, built through traditional aerospace contractors, takes anywhere from 3 to 5 years just to get to the launch pad.
So the traditional pipeline simply couldn't accommodate a rescue. They had to look outside the agency for someone willing to move dangerously fast.
Enter Catalyst Space Technologies.
Yes. They are a small, highly aggressive startup based out of Arizona. And when you look at their development timeline, it is staggering.
It's unheard of.
They designed, tested, and built the LNK rescue spacecraft in just 8 months.
8 months. Science Magazine called that timeline almost unprecedented for a mission involving NASA hardware.
I mean, how did they even do that?
Well, it highlights a philosophical shift we're seeing in the modern space industry. Partnering with a startup like Catalyst shows an acceptance of the mentality that speed beats perfection.
Right.
Catalyst achieved this by abandoning the bespoke engineering model. Instead of custom building every single microchip and sensor from scratch, they utilized commercial off-the-shelf components.
Oh, really? Just off-the-shelf parts?
Yeah. They adopted an agile, iterative development mindset. Because Swift is currently dropping 50 to 100 meters every single day, a delayed, perfectly engineered solution is, well, by definition, a failed solution.
Okay, but I have to push back on this approach. $30 million is basically couch change in the aerospace world.
True.
Doesn't a budget that incredibly tight mean Catalyst couldn't afford to build in any redundancy?
Yes.
I mean, they can't possibly have the backup systems that a traditional mission would demand. Aren't we just throwing a cheap, highly experimental Band-Aid at a $250 million problem and crossing our fingers?
Honestly, you're right to be skeptical. It is a Band-Aid, and the engineering community is deeply divided on whether this mission profile is brave or just reckless.
Reckless, yeah.
The lack of redundant backup systems on Link is a glaring vulnerability. If a primary sensor fails today, there isn't a secondary one waiting to take over.
So if it fails?
If Link fails, that $30 million is instantly gone, and 22 years of continuous scientific observation burns up in the atmosphere.
Wow.
But the stakes actually go far beyond Swift itself.
Right, the reputational risk.
Entirely. Mm-hmm. The whole emerging satellite servicing industry is watching this launch today.
Go pressure.
Right. If this highly publicized public-private gamble fails disastrously, like, for example, if the rescue vehicle accidentally shatters the telescope upon contact.
Which is a real possibility.
A very real possibility. The industry will take a massive reputational hit. Private investors might pull back their funding. Government space agencies might decide that robotic servicing is simply too risky to attempt again for another decade.
The whole concept of space rescue is literally on trial right now.
Exactly.
Okay, with the stakes being that high, the physical logistics of how they are actually getting this rescue vehicle into orbit are just fascinating.
Oh, the launch system.
Yes. I was reading through the mission briefings, and they aren't using a vertical concrete launch pad at Cape Canaveral. Catalyst chose an air launch system to get LANK into space.
Specifically, they are utilizing Northrop Grumman's Pegasus XL system, which is brilliantly unconventional compared to a standard rocket launch.
It is so wild to visualize. So they are using a heavily modified Lockheed L-1011 TriStar aircraft, affectionately named the Stargazer.
Such a great name.
Right, but what's incredible is that this specific plane was built in 1974.
It's a vintage aircraft.
It is the last operational L-1011 left in the entire world. It looks just like a classic vintage commercial airliner, but strapped completely to its belly is a massive three-stage solid-fuel rocket carrying the LNG spacecraft.
It is like a nesting doll of aerospace engineering.
Yes. The contrast between a vintage 1970s aircraft and a next-generation robotic space heist vehicle is striking, but the physics behind it are highly efficient, aren't they?
Extremely efficient. So the Stargazer takes off from a standard runway in the Marshall Islands, right?
Okay.
It climbs to an altitude of 39,000 feet and hits a cruising speed of Mach 0.82.
That's fast.
Very fast. And at that precise moment, it physically drops the rocket. The Pegasus XL free falls for 5 terrifying seconds to clear the aircraft before its solid rocket engines ignite, blasting it upward into orbit.
That's essentially giving a rocket a running start.
Exactly. And the advantages of that running start are significant. By launching from 39,000 feet, you bypass the troposphere.
Which is the thickest part of the lower atmosphere, right?
Right, the most drag-heavy part.
Yeah.
It saves an immense amount of fuel. Furthermore, it gives the mission planners incredible flexibility.
Because they aren't tied to a specific launch pad on the ground.
Exactly. They can launch out over the open ocean, completely bypassing the weather delays and scheduling conflicts that plague busy ground spaceports. It allows them to perfectly align their trajectory with Swift's decaying orbit.
So the running start gets Linkan to orbit in under 10 minutes. But arriving in the same orbital neighborhood is just the commute.
Yeah, that's the easy part.
The actual capture sequence is where the tension spikes. The mission scenario is meticulously broken down into 7 critical phases. Phases 2 and 3 involve a gradual approach and rendezvous where Link has to perfectly match the speed and rotation of the tumbling telescope.
And to achieve that synchronization, LNK relies on LIDAR.
Okay, LIDAR.
It is essentially bouncing millions of laser pulses off Swift every second to create a highly accurate, real-time, 3D topographical map of the telescope's tumbling motion.
Because it's moving unpredictably.
Right. It has to understand exactly how the object is moving in the dark vacuum of space before it can even think about moving in.
Which brings us to the make-or-break moment. Phase 4, the capture.
The scary part.
This is where the fact that Swift was absolutely not designed for servicing becomes a living nightmare for the engineering team. Modern satellites often include standard grapple points, essentially handles or magnetic docking ports designed for a robotic arm to latch onto.
Makes it easy.
Yeah. But Swift has none of that. It is a smooth, delicate, asymmetrical scientific instrument covered in fragile sunshades and sensors.
The difficulty of this cannot be overstated. I mean, Catalyst is attempting to physically grab an uncooperative, non-standard object that is hurtling around the Earth at thousands of miles per hour.
While it's spinning.
Right, while it is simultaneously rotating on multiple axes.
Trying to visualize this, it's less like catching a ball and more like trying to grab a spinning raw egg with metal tongs.
Oh, that's a stressful mental image.
But it's true. If the robotic arms apply unequal pressure for even a fraction of a second, the whole thing shatters.
That visual captures the mechanical tension perfectly. You have to apply exact symmetrical force to a delicate structure. Gunhee Lee, a lead engineer on the mission team, summed it up perfectly in the source material.
What did they say?
They noted, "This mission is like building a 1,000-piece puzzle while free-falling."
Jeez.
Every single piece of the telemetry and physical hardware has to snap together with millimeter precision.
So Olingyi is equipped with three highly advanced robotic arms. They have to extend and simultaneously grip Swift's main structural body, avoiding all the fragile instruments.
Right.
If we look at the worst case scenarios, the anxiety of the flight controllers makes complete sense. If Link's robotic arms miss their grip, or if a thruster misfires during the final approach, the two spacecraft could easily collide.
Oh, total.
And in an instant, both the rescue vehicle and the irreplaceable telescope would shatter into thousands of pieces of high-speed space debris.
Creating a massive hazard for everything else in that orbital lane.
But if Phase 4 is successful...
Fingers crossed.
The subsequent phases execute rapidly. Phase 5 is stabilization. LNK will use its onboard thrusters to counteract the tumbling motion, forcefully stopping the rotation and turning both independent vehicles into a single, rigid unit.
And once stabilized, Phase 6 begins. LNK fires its main engines to gradually push the combined mass back up to a safe, sustainable 600-kilometer orbit.
Once they reach that safe altitude, Phase 7 is simply letting go. LNK retracts its arms, backs away, and Swift gets back to work hunting gamma ray bursts for another decade.
If we connect this to the bigger picture,
yeah,
you know, beyond just Swift,
yeah,
the success of those seven phases represents a fundamental shift in how humanity operates in space.
Because historically, our approach to orbital infrastructure has been, a throwaway culture.
It's extremely wasteful, yeah.
We launch a multi-million dollar machine, and if it runs out of a few gallons of fuel or a minor antenna breaks, it instantly becomes multi-million dollar space trash.
Which is an insane economic model when you think about it.
Mm.
We don't throw away commercial Boeing 747 just because it needs an oil change or a new tire.
Exactly. But in space, we've accepted that reality for decades.
Well, we are finally moving toward a repair culture. Industry analysts project that by 2030, the satellite servicing sector could explode into an $8 to $12 billion market.
That is huge.
Huge. Now, to provide some historical context, Catalyst isn't the very first company to attempt in-orbit servicing. Northrop Grumman is the pioneer in this field.
Okay, Northrop Grumman.
Back in 2020 and 2021, they successfully launched two Mission Extension Vehicles, or MEVs.
Right. Those missions were successful. But there is a massive technical difference between what Northrop Grumman did and what Catalyst is attempting today, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely.
Northrop's MEVs successfully docked with aging communication satellites to take over their propulsion, effectively refueling them. But those targets were cooperative.
That's the key word, cooperative.
They had standard mechanical interfaces, specifically the Apogee kick motor ring that the MEV was custom designed to grab onto. Northrop Grumman basically had a key to the lock.
Exactly the distinction that matters here. Catalyst is doing the equivalent of picking a lock on a moving safe.
A moving safe.
Yes. If Lintas can definitively prove that autonomous robots can capture uncooperative satellites that lack any docking hardware, the entire market opens up.
Ah, I get it. Suddenly, thousands of legacy satellites become serviceable.
Exactly.
The projected breakdown of that future $10 billion market is fascinating. The research notes that roughly 40% of this new industry will be dedicated solely to refueling operations. Which makes you wonder, why is refueling such a massive chunk of that pie?
Because station-keeping thrusters are almost always the first critical system to fail. A satellite might have a perfectly healthy primary computer, incredible optical sensors, and fully functional solar panels generating infinite electricity.
Right.
But the moment it runs out of the physical chemical propellant needed to maintain its specific orbit and orientation, it becomes completely useless dead weight.
It can't aim its antennas.
Exactly. Refueling solves the most common point of failure.
And beyond refueling, another 25% of the market will be repair and upgrades. Imagine sending a robot to physically swap out a degraded battery or slapping a next-generation optical sensor onto a 15-year-old satellite chassis to instantly modernize it.
It's like upgrading your PC, but in space.
Yeah. And the remaining 12% is focused on taking out the trash, actively capturing and deorbiting dangerous space debris to keep orbital lanes clear. There is a great quote from aerospace CEO Chris Kemp in the notes.
What did he say?
He said, "Space is no longer a one-way environment. We can go back, repair, and reuse."
This transition built a foundational infrastructure that simply hasn't existed until today. We are essentially establishing repair shops and gas stations in low Earth orbit.
And this matters to you, the listener, right now. You might be thinking, cool, space robots, but how does this affect my Tuesday?
Right.
Think about the GPS network routing your car's navigation. Think about the global internet infrastructure bouncing your emails across continents. Mm. Think about the weather forecasts you check every single morning to plan your day.
All satellites.
Your entire modern life is heavily supported by a delicate, invisible web of satellites. Currently, when those satellites die, your services get more expensive because telecommunication companies and governments have to spend hundreds of millions to launch entirely new replacements.
But if Catalyst proves this technology works,
it fundamentally changes the economics of the entire global communication network. It lowers the cost of maintaining the infrastructure that runs our world.
It creates a sustainable ecosystem rather than a disposable one.
So what does this all mean? Let's bring all these threads together. Today's launch is nothing short of awe-inspiring. You have a scrappy, fast-moving startup from Arizona stepping up to save a 22-year-old historic telescope.
Against all odds.
It is a $30 million gamble to prove that humanity can dynamically fix our most advanced scientific tools while they are literally tumbling and falling out of the sky.
And regardless of the outcome today, whether Ely NK gracefully captures Swift and boosts it back home, or if it tragically ends in a collision, the telemetry and data we gather from this single attempt is going to permanently alter spacecraft design going forward.
Because no engineer wants to build a smooth, slippery box ever again.
Never again. Future satellite architectures will absolutely be mandated to include standard attachment points.
Handles. Just put handles on it.
Literally just handles. They will be built with standardized optical reflectors for LiDAR rendezvous and modular plug-and-play components that are easy for a robotic arm to swap out in a vacuum.
Mm.
We will learn from the engineering hurdles of this capture, no matter what happens in orbit today.
It is an incredible story of innovation and agility. But before we wrap up this deep dive, there is one profound implication that wasn't explicitly spelled out in the research, but it has been lingering in the back of my mind ever since we started discussing the mechanics of those three robotic arms.
Mm. This raises an important question. Where are you going with this?
Think about the dual-use nature of this technology, specifically regarding global space security.
Okay.
If Catalyst successfully proves today that a small, privately built, relatively cheap spacecraft can autonomously hunt down, perfectly match speeds with, and physically grab an uncooperative, tumbling satellite that has no docking ports.
Yeah.
What happens when a government decides to point that exact same technology at someone else's hardware?
Oh, wow. The strategic implications of that are chilling.
Right. Could this exact same life-saving technology be used in the future to silently approach, physically capture, blind, or entirely disable another country's classified spy satellite without their permission?
You're completely right. The line between a benevolent repair vehicle and a hostile orbital interceptor is, well, it's incredibly thin.
It purely comes down to intent.
Exactly. If you can catch a falling telescope, you can certainly catch a communication satellite.
It is definitely something provocative to mull over as you watch the skies tonight. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep your eyes on the news over the next few hours to see exactly how the Swift rescue mission unfolds.
It's going to be wild.
Whether it ends in triumph or debris, it is going to be quite the show.